Support comes from WFAE members and Mazda of South Charlotte, dedicated to those who believe a car should stir one's emotions and deliver a heightened state of driving. More at MazdaofSouthCharlotte.com. This is Charlotte Talks. I'm Mike Collins on the local news roundup. It's back to school on Monday for some students at CMS. More will follow that as the state refocuses vaccine distribution to include teachers, but not until after CMS returns to the classroom. The transit plan hits a snag. People in the northern part of the county want some bang for their bucks, and they may get it. And Charlotte City Council votes to rename 9 streets with names tied to the Confederacy and white supremacy. They're going to take those names off, not name them with those names. Badly worded sentence. Here to bring us up to date on those stories and more is WFAE's health reporter, Claire Donnelly. Welcome back to the program.
Thank you. Good morning.
Good morning. Eric Spanberg returns. He's managing editor for the Charlotte Business Journal. Good morning to you.
Good morning, Mike.
Mary C. Curtis is a columnist for RollCall.com, host of their podcast Equal Time, and a contributor to WCCB-TV. Welcome back.
Good morning, Mike.
And we welcome for the first time on this stage, Hunter Sines, a reporter for WCNC-TV. Good morning, Hunter. Thank you for being here. Appreciate it.
Yeah, happy to be here. Good morning to you.
And let me start with you. A little bit about you, Hunter. Hunter grew up in Texas, watching Tom Brokaw on his grandfather's knee. So they sent him off to Syracuse for his journalism degree, then off to Wisconsin to be on TV. This rhymes, doesn't it? And then he found out that it was really cold up there, and he came to his senses and came down here. That cleared his mind, I guess. And this morning he begins a new chapter in his life and career. Does that about sum it up? Does that about sum it up?
Mark this day, Hunter. It'll be a milestone.
Oh, I'm going to mark it. It took a good pitch to get me here. No, I'm just kidding. Here it's a hoot on this show, so I'm happy to be here. But yes, that summed it up. You summed it up perfectly, Mike.
Well, good. And we pay well, too, don't we? All right. On Monday, CMS is sending students and teachers back into the classroom. K-8 schools will open with students attending 2 days a week. Middle and high schools will start the following week with small groups of students attending 1 week in person and then staying home for 2 weeks. This is all very confusing to me. CMS Superintendent Ernest Winston has said that this decision is not without risk.
We won't be able to eliminate all risk. That is impossible. But we do believe we put practices and procedures in place to reduce those risks as much as possible.
And on this program, I think it was yesterday, School Board District 1 Representative Rhonda Lennon said that the board felt it was time to move ahead with a return to in-class education.
CMS is not leading the charge in getting kids back in the classroom. Districts surrounding us have been back. Wake County's coming back on Monday, I think K-3 full-time. Iredell County's been back on Plan A for months since August. Guilford is back for the younger kids. Salem Forsyth has been back. So the data's out there. We're seeing that in those communities that the virus has not really had any impact with the schools being opened.
One of our other guests yesterday made a point of saying that Mecklenburg is not unlike any of those systems, except maybe for Wake, because of the size of Mecklenburg and the density of our population here as opposed to other school districts. But Claire, what does the science say about all of this? What are health officials saying about safety and returning kids to the classroom?
Right. Yeah. I mean, it's a very interesting question, and it's a super sticky wicket. So this week, when Governor Cooper announced that they were opening up vaccines later this month for like a small segment of group 3, so the essential workers, which would be teachers, childcare workers, he in the same press conference emphasized that teachers could go back to teaching in person in the classroom without getting vaccinated. So there is science from, or there was a study from, I believe, Duke and UNC that said that there was very little transmission in the classroom. I think there was no transmission between students and teachers. So that's what kind of we've been hearing from Secretary Cohen and from Cooper this, you know, this whole time, that, yeah, we can get them back.
And yet, as school systems around this country are making that decision to go back to the classroom because there's little evidence, according to some scientists, that there's a transmission, any increase in transmission, students in Europe are being sent home because they're finding that is not true. And that as these new, more virulent, more contagious variants emerge, they are becoming increasingly concerned about the infection rates in schools. Has anybody talked about that in this area?
I haven't heard a ton about variants in schools. Maybe some other people on the panel have, but I do know, I mean, so just yesterday we got news from North Carolina's health department that the South Africa variant, there was a case of the South Africa variant identified in North Carolina. The concern with those variants is that, so there's one from the UK also, one from Brazil. Mm-hmm. The concern is that they're more contagious. They don't, so far, they don't necessarily seem to be making people more sick. There's also concern that they make vaccines less effective. So both Pfizer and Moderna are 95% effective against the old variant, so the original variant, what we've had since March. The question is just how much less effective are these vaccines against the new strains?
WFAE's education reporter Andos Helms has highlighted that parents are extremely frustrated with the school system, and they want more. They want more. They want to go back right now. Completely, totally, absolutely. But as these variants emerge, and as we watch the up and downs of the, although the infection rate and hospitalization rate are on the decline, as we watch this, do we anticipate a full return to in-person instruction this semester? Is that the plan at the moment? Does anybody know?
That doesn't seem to be because, I mean, you're talking about partial weeks and rotations. With the schools, particularly with the middle and high schoolers. So that seems unlikely based on what I know, but Mary may know a little bit more.
I don't know much more, but I do know that there's so many other factors involved as some of the schools, the way they're constructed, the air quality isn't as healthy as it could be. So it's a lot more complicated. We see in other cities like Chicago where the teachers union and the city, they were at a stalemate. I think they have some kind of negotiation to try to go back partially. So it is a very fraught and controversial topic. And while some parents want to go back in, a lot more are very hesitant. And in some homes, you have a lot of kids going back into homes where they're big families living together. So it might put the elderly folks or other folks in their homes in danger.
We have President Biden urging a return to the classroom if conditions are safe. Governor Cooper's on the same page. This week, senators approved a bill requiring K through 12 public schools to reopen. And I believe they're now in a conference with the House in Raleigh on that before they sent it off to the governor. What is the status of that and what is likely to come out of that bill about going back to school? And do we need it?
Well, the legislators think that we need it. The governor doesn't think we need it. The administration essentially wants local districts to make the decision. A couple of caveats here. I mean, first, remember that the all remote option remains virtually everywhere. So you wouldn't have to go back if you didn't want to go back. But there is, as you said, Mike, and others said, there is still a lot of confusion about all these different plans, all these different moving parts. I mean, I was talking to one of my daughters last night. She said if it goes as planned, she would go basically 2 weeks the rest of the year. That's if everything goes well. And that's in school because you go 1 week on, 2 weeks off. So in a way, we're having a lot of fighting about something that is quickly becoming sort of a moot point. But to get back to the original question, the House and Senate have to negotiate this. It'll probably happen next week. And I would imagine the Republican majority will pass something.
And Claire, we're going to talk about vaccines and getting teachers vaccinated in a second. But there was some discussion on this program yesterday. We had a school board member on. We had a parent and a teacher on. We had a person who's involved heavily with committees set up by the school system. And one of the things that came up was the fact that even though it seems to be safe, you can't control the behavior of people outside the classroom. You don't know what teachers are doing outside the classroom. Some people believe that this is still a hoax. You can't control what the parents of children do and how they act and whether they congregate outside of their so-called pod. has that been discussed at the school level at all? Because maybe the kids aren't bringing it back and forth, but maybe the teachers will, or maybe the kids' parents will. I mean, has this been discussed?
I'm not sure if that's been discussed, but you're totally right. I mean, one of the main sticking points throughout the pandemic has been you can't control other people's behavior, right? So no matter what, I mean, even with nursing homes, we saw some nursing home staff. I mean, the only way that the virus would get into the nursing home would be through nursing home staff, because they're the ones who are out circulating in the community. So I think that's the concern with the variants as well, is if it's easier to pick it up, if it's more contagious, then yeah, I mean, exactly, you're right. You can't control that. And the other thing I was gonna say is there is also some concern among some teachers that it's not always as easy to get a full remote assignment. So like if you are concerned about your risk of contracting the coronavirus, that you may not necessarily be able to get full remote while the students can choose that, or the parents can choose that for their kids. So that's kind of I think that's been kind of a bone of contention also.
Yeah, to Claire's point really quick, Mike, this week at the board meeting, there was one teacher who spoke up and said, I'm a breast cancer survivor, and now I'm also going through another form of cancer. And now they're putting it up to the principals to decide on a school by school basis of which teachers can have that remote classroom still. And she's saying, listen, I was denied that. And so now I'm being forced to go to the classroom when we go back.
There was some discussion about that, who makes that decision on this program yesterday. And it seems a little iffy, particularly if you have an underlying condition and you're turned down. What are your options? Governor Cooper has called on lawmakers to support a supplemental budget request for $468 million that would offer direct payments of $2,500 to teachers and principals, $2,000 to community college and UNC system workers, and $1,500 to non-certified school personnel. What for? Why are they giving this money out? What's the point? Is it because of the extra work they've had to do during this pandemic, or is it for something else, or do we know?
In terms of the bonuses for the educators, the governor has said because they haven't received raises in the past two years. So that's the simple answer, yes.
And do we know what the progress on that is and what the likely progress might be going forward?
The what I have seen on that is that the legislature was not amenable to that, at least at first blush. And then there was mentioned this week by one of the governor's aides that perhaps a way to fund this would be the next round of federal COVID money, that they could take some of that money that's allocated to North Carolina and pay the bonuses that way.
Okay. The Biden administration's new CDC director has said that vaccinations of teachers are not a prerequisite for safely reopening the schools. But teachers around the country have a different take on that. And this week, Governor Cooper decided to make a change. Secretary of North Carolina's Department of Health and Human Services, Dr. Mandy Cohen, explained his move to put teachers at the front of the vaccination line.
Anyone who must be in person, like teachers, bus drivers, van drivers, custodial and maintenance staff, and food service worker, will be eligible to take their shot.
So this won't begin until February 24th, that's a week and a half, after CMS teachers go back, which is next Monday, the 15th. I have 30 seconds. How quickly are teachers likely to be able to get vaccinated? Claire?
Well, Mecklenburg County at 8:30 this morning opened 3,200 more appointments, and literally within minutes, the website crashed, the phone lines were jammed, because teachers could start making appointments today. But that, again, like you said, would be after they're back. So
there has got to be a better way to get in line for vaccinations. This is just not working anywhere in the country. We have to take a break. We'll come back with more on vaccinations and more in a moment at Charlotte Talks on WFAE.
If being more active is a goal this year, WFAE's Charlotte Walks can keep you moving. Commit to run, walk, or hike during our virtual step challenge now through the end of February. Registration and information at WFAE.org. Charlotte Walks is sponsored by Ortho Carolina.
It's Charlotte Talks on Listener Funded, 90.7 WFAE and 90.3 WFHE. I'm Mike Collins. It's the local news roundup. Every Friday we do this. Claire Donnelly is here, our health reporter from WFAE News. Mary C. Curtis from Roll Call and WCCB-TV. Hunter Sines, reporter for WCNC-TV, that's NBC here. And Eric Spanberg, who is the managing editor for the Charlotte Business Journal. We were talking about vaccinations and teachers. And one teacher at East Mecklenburg, a math teacher there, Megan Barger, told WBTV that she's already called to schedule her vaccination because being vaccinated is what will make her feel safe.
While I absolutely miss being in person, I want nothing more to be in person. I also want that to be safe. And so a vaccine to me is that key difference between being in person and also being safe.
Now, the state is already allowing people who are healthcare workers, those 65 and older, and those who live or work in long-term care facilities to get vaccinated. People in the next group will include grocery store employees, police officers, farm workers, restaurant employees, but they have to wait till March the 10th. And I'm wondering, since now teachers can get vaccinated beginning February 24th, did they move people out of the way? Have they displaced people? How is that working?
Yeah, so, and feel free to jump in, guys. I feel like,
this is our health section.
You are on an island. Okay.
Take it away. Vaccines. Talk about vaccines all the time. I feel like, so this is interesting. They didn't bump people out of the way. They just picked a small subgroup of group three, which is the essential workers. So, and it was interesting. I mean, you played that piece of tape from Mandy Cohen before the break, but they never really gave an explanation for why teachers are, in-person teachers should go ahead of other essential workers who have to go in person. There was never any explicit reasoning given. Well, Eric, I mean,
Well, I was just gonna say, Claire, because I know you're on all these calls too, I mean, it's just an inherent disconnect, and I know everybody's trying to do the right thing here, but it's an inherent disconnect to say a couple of weeks ago, as the CDC and the governor and many others did, hey, look, we can go back to school. We should go back to school. It's safe. You don't have to be vaccinated. And then turn around and say, yeah, we're going back to school, and we're going to put you in the front of the line to be vaccinated, even though you don't have to be vaccinated. I mean, how do you make sense of that?
Right. It was like in the same breath that it was, we're putting teachers ahead, but also you can go back in person safely. So if I were a teacher, I would be kind of confused. Like, so if I'm eligible to get vaccinated before a grocery store worker or a restaurant worker, but I can also go back safely.
I know you're all going to find this difficult to get your heads around and believe, but a lot of this must be politics. And a lot of it must be pressure coming not only from parents to open schools, but also from teachers who are saying, I'm not going back unless I get my vaccine. Right. But Gibby Harris, who is Mecklenburg County's health director, reacted this way, and it was kind of puzzling, to moving teachers to the head of the line.
I'm assuming the state has specific reasons for making the decision to start with teachers and childcare workers. And as always, we have been consistent in working through the state's guidelines, and we'll continue to do that this time. I would find it extremely difficult to prioritize any one group over another.
So is she saying that she doesn't see the reason for this prioritization, or merely that she's happy that it wasn't her call?
I think choice B is definitely in the running here. I mean, I think most of us were on that call the other day, and probably all of us had the same reaction. I mean, your jaw almost drops because she is pretty much saying, hey, look, I don't know if I would have made that decision. I'm really glad I didn't have to make that decision. And it goes back to what I was just saying. On the one hand, you have science telling you that you can go back without the staff being vaccinated. And then in the next breath, you're saying, no, we have to vaccinate the educators first or we can't go back. I don't know how to explain that. I don't know if it's capable of being explained.
And it was a 360 from what she told county commissioners 24 to 48 hours just prior to this announcement that now we're going to prioritize this subgroup. She literally went before them and said it would be way too challenging to do that. And she really didn't see the reason for it, as Eric kind of alluded to. And then at a press conference, she turns the table and It came as a surprise, but to Claire's point, I think it's also confusing for all of those other essential workers who are scratching their heads saying, come on, it was my turn, and you're saying it's safe to return to the classroom, but what about me in the grocery store? Where have the studies been for that? And now I'm kind of put on the back burner.
The other thing too is, I mean, at the county level, at the state level, there just aren't enough vaccines. So we're only, according to Mandy Cohen, we're only about halfway through vaccinating people 65 and older. So now you open it up to 240,000 teachers, and we're getting 150,000 doses from the federal government every week. I mean, it's just, there are more people who are eligible now. I mean, there have always been more people that are eligible than vaccine doses. Now we've really increased that. So yeah, I mean, it's a real problem. And Gibby also mentioned possibly figuring out a way to kind of target the older population to make sure they don't get bumped by, you know, teachers. And I mean, it's just, yeah, it's kind of a...
On the federal level too, you can see they're trying to hit this more demand than supply, because you've seen the Biden administration and his health team now say they're going to push a lot more vaccines out to the states.
Mm-hmm. I was just going to add, there's also no policing of it. Gibby came on and said, we can either focus on getting the vaccines out, or we can focus on policing people cutting in line. Remember, in phase one and phase two, you could pretty much prove easily that you're a healthcare worker or you're over 65. There's no real way, unless you're showing your school badge or ID. And at this point, they aren't going to do that, according to Gibby.
So we also did a program this week focusing on the suspicion within the Black community of getting this vaccine or any other vaccine being promoted by the government for reasons that date back centuries, actually, but also because of the experimentation that was done on the Tuskegee Airmen and here in North Carolina as well. And so they're being grossly underrepresented in a community that is mostly greatly affected by this virus, because a lot of them are frontline workers. So Hunter, I know you did a report on this week. Is the disparity here because of the wariness that people in the Black community have of this, or is it something else, like it's just impossible for them to get in line somehow?
It's a mixture of both still. I mean, when we went out to these underserved communities and spoke to people in parking lots and such and asked them, you know, how easy is it for you to get signed up, or how easy is it for you to get to Bojangles if you aren't with Atrium or Novant? It's difficult. Some of these people don't have transportation. Some of these people can't get online because they may not have internet access as easily as others. But there is also that hesitancy. I also remember one woman told me, well, they haven't been to my neighborhood. They haven't been to my community. I need them to do a pop-up clinic here. So there is a want from a lot of the Black and Latino communities to get these vaccines, as much as there is, I think, hesitancy on one end, but it's just a matter of getting out there to these communities. It's something that the health department is trying to do, especially on the weekends. We saw it over at the Hindu Center, I believe it was last weekend, and that was really successful. They're also going on, you know, Hispanic radio stations, trying to appeal to those subgroups. But it's a difficult thing when you're only getting so many vaccines, and that's the big problem right now.
Yeah. I think that too, this crisis has shown inequities that's throughout the system in many areas, but in this healthcare system. And a whole bunch of minority health professionals have come out and said, what you need to do is, as Hunter said, be in the community. You have to come in there and have people that people trust to do this. And it's not just the suspicion. You know, my husband got it, and we belong to an insurance company that gave, you know, the notice. And then he had to go way down in Matthews. So you needed a car. Right. And then it says you can come at this certain time. Suppose you have a job that you just can't say, I've got to jump up and be there at 1 o'clock in the afternoon. It's so many factors. Yeah. It's not just that the reasonable suspicion. It becomes so many hurdles that most people, I just think, don't think about it. They think, well, boy, you could just do this. Well, yeah. You just can't.
And in many cases, you have to have access to the internet and understand how to use it to make an appointment to get the shot. And that's difficult.
Broadband, the broadband inequities, we know throughout the country.
So is anything being done to address this problem in that community here or elsewhere? Because this is a nationwide problem.
You do hear a lot. I was going to say, I was on a call yesterday, Dr. Scott Rissmiller with Atrium. I think he was talking about the next clinic at the Speedway and some of the mass vaccination events. And he was saying that underserved communities are an area of emphasis for them, including transportation, including bilingual notices, including pop-up shot clinics. So I think there is a recognition and an attempt to rectify this. But as we've seen with these numbers, the initial results are not good. And to Mary's point, all of this is pointing out the just gross inequities that were in our society already, and they're just worsened by the pandemic.
Claire. Mike, go ahead. Sorry.
Well, I was just going to say, I think the Latino community is even worse. The last time I looked at the state numbers, it was like 2% of all of the vaccines that have been administered in the state so far. All the first doses are to members of the Latino community in the state. So,
yeah, I was going to get in, just touch on those numbers here at the county level. I mean, the Hispanic community is 13% of Mecklenburg County, and they only account for 4% of the vaccines. The Black community, 31% of the population here, only getting 16% of the shots. And you compare that to our white population, I mean, it's 47%, nearly 50% of the population, but 72% of the shots are going to our white population. And, you know, there is a caveat in that first phase. If we remember, they were healthcare workers, and Gibby Harris has come on the record and said, listen, a lot of that population here at the local level is white female. So there were a heavily white population that was getting the vaccine in the first phase, but the numbers I think speak for themselves. And to Mary's point, you know, it is shining a light on the inequities, but it always seems like we're playing catch up when these things happen. You know, we knew a vaccine rollout, to be a little critical here, was coming for months. So where was the prep work to try to say, hey, when it does become available, and I know it's harder in hindsight, and hindsight's 2020, but where was the planning to get into these communities at a grassroots effort when the vaccines became available?
And remember, go ahead, Mike.
No, that's okay.
I was just going to say a quick point, Mike. You remember when we started talking about all this back in March of last year, we already knew about the inequities in terms of testing. We talked about that for weeks, if not months. And so to Hunter's point, there should have been a lot of planning going on to make sure that the vaccines did not end up in the same position, which is where we are.
So before we move on, let me just correct something that I said a minute ago, and that was the fact that I alluded to suspicion in the Black community because of medical experimentation, and I brought up the Tuskegee Airmen. It's not the Tuskegee Airmen. It's the Tuskegee right. Syphilis study.
Syphilis.
So right. There is a difference there.
Two things in Tuskegee.
Yeah, okay. So Charlotte City Council voted unanimously this week to rename 9 streets that honor Confederate soldiers, segregationists, and people who played a prominent role in advancing white supremacy. Which streets are among the 9?
We have streets. I don't know if I have all 9, but some of them
I
are
got
named.
Them.
Okay. Well, I'll give you a couple. Jefferson Davis, Stonewall Jackson, Zebulon Vance, Cameron Morrison, and Mike, you can pick it up from there.
Acock.
Acock, Barringer Drive, Zebulon Avenue, West Hill. They've already changed the name. It was pointed out to me by the mayor that they've already changed the name of the Jefferson Davis Street on the west side to Jeff Davis Street. The residents took it upon themselves to do that. I'm not sure what difference that makes because he's still Jefferson Davis.
Yeah.
There are streets recommended. These streets were recommended for name changes by the Legacy Commission, which was a commission that was put together by the mayor to take a look at that street names and other things that have been named after white supremacists and Confederate emblems. And they found that there were no Confederate memorials on public property, so they ditched that, changing any of those. And they also found that all of the streets named for people who lived before the 1800s, all of those people had slaves or had connections to slavery. So they left them alone. Is that temporary, or will they go back and do that? Because it's difficult to change the name of streets. It's a very difficult and expensive proposition.
Yeah,
you almost have to change the name of every street in Charlotte. I mean, it just shows you the history and how much our country is steeped in the legacy of enslavement, and particularly this region, how it was built in that way.
Yeah.
So, you know, but so many people are saying if you're going to name them after somebody else, and they've talked about Julius Chambers, the civil rights attorney, historic, of course, head of the NAACP Legal Defense Fund, and others. Others have said, well, whenever you name them after people, in the future, you might look back at their legacy and find some flaws in it.
Well, it's interesting you mentioned that, because this is happening all over the country, this reexamination of what of who we honor. And some see this as an example of cancel culture or as an attempt to erase history. But Larkin Eggleston, a member of city council, says he sees it differently.
It doesn't mean we are erasing that history. It doesn't mean we don't teach that history. It simply means we don't honor those folks in the ways that they have been honored up till now.
And just as a side personal note, I went to T.C. Williams High School in Alexandria, Virginia. Remember the Titans. I got an email 2 days ago. The City of Alexandria School Board is renaming that school, and they wanted to know what we thought, as alumni, we should call the school. Why are they renaming it? Because he had segregationist ties. T.C. Williams was a segregationist. And the irony here is that when that school was built and opened in 1965, they built it to integrate the city's schools, and they named it after a segregationist. Councilman Braxton Winston has suggested that we no longer name streets after people, and Tariq Bakari suggested we name nothing after people because social mores change. What's your take on that, Mary?
Well, I mean, I think that you can always say that social mores, even at the time, would say that enslavement of people, that that was wrong and incorrect. It just showed what people honored. So I have no problems with taking those names off. I've often felt what a Black student would feel like going to Robert E. Lee High School or something like that. And I also think this points to the fact that we need to teach history in a different and more complete way. I mean, we're in Black History Month, and people said, do we need it? Well, yeah, in the sense because we don't teach American history. So we've seen those efforts come forth, and I think this is all a part of that. Unfortunately, you also see pushback on that of people who say, we don't want to teach about certain things that would put America in a bad light. But actually, it just shows that America is a complicated place, that it hasn't always lived up to its promises. And I'd have to jump in here now and say, like, I'm wearing Ida B. Wells a button because she's a terrific journalist and an idol. And we need to know more about people like her.
Also, honesty is the best policy. My grandmother told me that, and so she must have been right because she was right about everything else. We have to take a break. It's Charlotte Talks on WFAE. Support comes from WFAE members and Mazda of South Charlotte, committed to drivers that share Mazda's passion that cars make driving matter. More at MazdaofSouthCharlotte.com. It's Charlotte Talks on WFAE and WFHE. I'm Mike Collins. It's the local news roundup. We're coming into the home stretch with Claire Donnelly, our healthcare reporter here at WFAE News. Hunter Sines is with us, a reporter for WCNC, on his maiden voyage. Eric Spanberg, a managing editor of the Charlotte Business Journal, and Mary C. Curtis, a columnist and contributor to RollCall.com and WCCB-TV. Last year, we all know, the Charlotte Moves Task Force unveiled an ambitious transit plan that will cost between $8 and $12 billion and which will require a tax hike, both a sales tax and most likely a property tax hike. The plan includes a lot of different modes of transportation, but the shining star of it all, the focal point, had been the Silver Line, which was going to be light rail from Matthews to Belmont. What that caught the attention of people in the northern part of the county, who last time they voted for a tax increase for transit, feel that they got nothing in return except something they didn't want, and that was the toll lanes. They wanted the red line, the commuter rail line from downtown to Davidson. But Norfolk Southern has the right of way on that line, and they don't seem to be interested at all in sharing it. But on Monday night, Assistant City Manager and City Planning Director Taiwo Jioba told the council that the so-called red line might see traction if the General Assembly approves the tax increase. And Mr. Jioba told council, changes in leadership at the railroad has opened the door to possible consideration.
We feel that there's been changes in leadership at Norfolk Southern that allows us to be able to re-engage them in a positive way.
Well, City Manager Marcus Jones quickly jumped in to put the brakes on that idea.
I would say nothing has changed. It's going to be very difficult to get this coalition together.
And Hunter, even as Mr. Jaiobo was speaking at that council meeting, you received an email from a spokesperson at Norfolk Southern. What did they tell you?
Yeah, me and a couple of other reporters, I know Eric did as well, as we talked about earlier, but so I reach out to Norfolk Southern and I say, hey, the city is saying this right now to our city leaders. Is this true? And they come back and saying, no, we still have no plans to share the tracks. Our stance has not changed on this. I, of course, am texting and communicating with some of the other beat reporters, and one of them was Joe Bruno, and he put it like this. Basically, if you're on a dating app, this is perfect for the Valentine's weekend we're going into. If you're on a dating app, Joe Bruno says, in true Joe fashion, it's as if the city of Charlotte has swiped right and is, of course, messaging Norfolk Southern, and Norfolk Southern is not wanting anything to do with it, and Charlotte is not getting the message. And that pretty much sums it up very well, I think. It is, in all seriousness, it's going to be a big uphill battle. We know the history that Norfolk Southern has not had in sharing the tracks. And I know they're trying to appeal to those northern towns that are, of course, anti-increase on the sales tax. But man, that is a mighty mountain.
So Hunter, are you saying we should not expect roses anytime soon? Is that what you're saying? Yeah.
So, exactly what I'm saying.
Many thorns.
To embolden and underline that point, here's what the email that they sent Hunter from Norfolk Southern said. We value greatly our relationship with the city of Charlotte and CATS. Our obligations and responsibilities have not changed yet. So at this time, we have not reconsidered our stance on this proposal. And they stressed that freight operations on that track preclude, that means don't allow, passenger-only operating windows. But on this program on Wednesday, Charlotte Mayor Vi Lyle seemed confident that Norfolk Southern would act like a good corporate citizen.
We are just as much of an economic driver for railroad and logistics. When you start thinking about the future of this, and I know railroads have been around for a very long time, but change is coming. So I hope that they'll see that they have an interest, even though they have a position right now that they're not doing it, they should have an interest in getting this solved.
Is she being naive, or does she know something we don't?
I think she's being optimistic. But Mike, I was going to say, to start at the start, the fact that the red line is all of a sudden, which is what they call this commuter line from uptown to North Mecklenburg, the fact that it is sort of jumped to the head of the class just miraculously with no debate is quite interesting in and of itself. And
yeah, it wasn't even in the transit plan at all. And suddenly it's the prime suspect.
And so, there was another exchange that was very interesting during that discussion on Monday night, Mike, which is one of the council members was asking about the ratios of money and how it would be spent and where, and mentioned that $8 billion to $12 billion figure that you mentioned. And the city manager's response was, oh, no, let's not use that number. That's a task force number. We're working with some new numbers right now. They need to be refined, but we'll be discussing that soon. Now, Mike, I don't want to break anyone's heart or make them think that Santa Claus isn't real or anything like that. But typically, when you start saying those numbers aren't the right numbers, they're going to go up.
Yes.
I don't know that. He didn't say, but I would be on the lookout for that.
Well, unlike the Greenway projects, at least we're getting some advance warning that we may need some more money here. Okay, time for a little quiz. What do you think this sound is? Any guesses?
Oh, gosh. Does that go back to way west, yesteryear of 2019 when we had a streetcar?
Yes. Play that again, Wendy. Play that again. That is the sound of the new Charlotte streetcar. They're testing it on the Gold Line every night, evidently, but they're doing it at night. When did this testing start? Anybody know?
started, I think, either Monday or Tuesday. And it really got going on when I think Wednesday night was the night they had all the media out. So, and this will go on for some time. And I think, Mike, you're leading us to when will the full 4 miles open, which I think is late April, early May is the timetable right now.
Well, I've seen video of this thing. It's really, I have to say, it's impressive. It's a sleek, modern, big city, at least Portland. Look.
Is that insulting Charlotte or Portland? I can't tell.
Yes. The answer is yes.
At least for a streetcar, it looks pretty cool. And they're going to start testing it in the daytime because they want to test it at night first when there's less traffic. But perhaps they haven't noticed there isn't any traffic anymore because of the pandemic. But this is going to open for the 4 mile stretch from what? From where does it start?
Basically, you're going to be going from a little bit past Novant Presbyterian Hospital. I think it's Sunnyside Lane or Sunnyside Avenue. Right. I always mix those two up. And then you go to Johnson C. Smith, Historic West End, and then you'll have 6 miles left to go after that.
And eventually, they hope it'll be 10 miles long, and it will go from Eastland Mall site to the Rosa Parks Transportation Center. This has been it's taken longer to build this rail line than it did to build the pyramids. but it's been a major problem for people along Elizabeth Avenue who run businesses and the people who live near and had to use the Hawthorne Street Bridge, which has been built and rebuilt 500 times now. At least it's open now. So will this running of the streetcar make up the deficit for these folks? Will they get some of their investments back in their businesses, et cetera?
I spoke to the GM over at Hawthorne's Pizza right there before Hawthorne Lane Bridge. And I think that some of those business owners, quite frankly, Mike, I think they're so jaded by the process and the pain that they've had to go through that when I asked him the question, are you hopeful that this brings new business, you know, post-pandemic of people coming from the West Side or from Uptown? And he's like, I'm going to be honest, I don't know what to expect, but I don't believe that places that have restaurants in Uptown and the historic West End, people are going to jump on a four mile track and a train ride to get over to Hawthorne's Pizza. He just told me, I just want it to be done. And they have been saying that, as we know, for years. However, contrary to that, you go over to the historic West End and there's a barbershop over there who I spoke with, and they're excited about it. They're hoping that post-pandemic, you know, people may, you know, take a lunch break from Uptown, hop on the train and go get a haircut and then come back and it will bring new business. So they're excited. I think it's a mixture of both. It just depends on the toll that this has taken on your business that's right on that rail line.
Here's the million-dollar question, because when prior to shutting it all down, the streetcar, using the old streetcar from the early 20th century, it was free. I assume they're going to charge money to ride this thing. Will people ride it?
Well, that's a good question, Mike, and you're right. It was free at first. Then they went to fares, and of course, it will be all fares when they resume service and expand it in April or May. I mean, you get the usual answer. The transit supporters say, of course, it's going to go gangbusters, and the people who have fought this are convinced that no one will ever get on it. And I hate to give you the squishy answer of it's probably in the middle, but it's probably in the middle.
Okay. Mayor Vial Isles has appointed a committee to find ways to shore up the city's arts and culture sector. They met for the first time this week. They promised to move quickly while bringing fresh perspective to this perpetually underfunded sector. Who is on the committee?
Go ahead.
Mayor Pro Tem Julie Isalt is heading it. And they're all city council members, Tariq Bakari, Ed Driggs, Malcolm Graham, and Braxton Winston. And we've seen this perpetual discussion about underfunded arts, the role of arts and culture in Charlotte, how can they reach out to communities? And then we saw pre-COVID, of course, voters rejected that quarter cent sales tax to bolster it. And then since COVID, of course, the arts groups have been totally hit. And so they're trying to figure out long-term policy plans as well as looking to plan the next city budget and what's going to happen with that.
And prior to the pandemic, the Arts and Science Council, which has been the leading funder of arts in this area forever, had seen that their highly successful funding model simply collapsed because people don't give it the office anymore, essentially. Or people aren't forced to give it the office. And that's the real truth of it. And they hired a new director who resigned recently. He shepherded it through a very tough time with the pandemic hit, et cetera. What kind of fresh ideas does City Council have about this problem, which is a perpetual problem and one across the country, actually?
It is one across the country. One of the things they're doing, Mike, the first meeting was, in essence, a lot of kind of trying to get their arms around, okay, what are we going to do? What's the timetable? How are we going to do this? One of the things they're going to do is look at several other cities who have come up with these kinds of long-term plans to stabilize arts funding. Dallas, Boston, and Louisville are three of the ones that they're looking at. This is not going to be easy. As you mentioned, Mike, this is a perpetual problem. Even before the pandemic, they were looking for double the funding from the city and the county, the ASC was. And one of the big things that you're going to hear, I think, over and over is that we in the public sector are willing to give X, but only if the private sector is going to step in and give equal help or significant help. I think that's where this thing is headed.
Well, we'll keep our eye on it because it's a perpetual problem, and we're almost to the point, I think, we're going to have to build from the ground up as opposed to reviving something that was there before the pandemic and before the ASC funding model collapsed. City Council is also looking at housing policy. They voted unanimously this week to put a report on housing discrimination before the full council. This is about Section 8 housing, is it not?
It's about housing vouchers, yeah, right, and landlords and their willingness to accept those vouchers.
And Section 8 housing goes to people who are in the lower echelons of the socioeconomic spectrum, and the federal government provides them with checks for housing. And evidently there are landlords in Charlotte who don't want to take those checks. They won't rent to those people. This is guaranteed income. Why?
There are a number of reasons. There are inspections that are required to sync up the funding. Some of the tenant damages, a lot of the tenant damages apparently are not guaranteed by Section 8 funding. If you have someone come and go and leave a lot of damage. Mm-hmm. And then there are rent caps, in essence, of what those tenants can pay. And so all of those things have frustrated landlords, and particularly at a time when, you know, the market has been pretty healthy. You know, rents have been going up. You've seen all these apartments. Now the pandemic's changed some of that, but that's how we got to this point. And one other piece, Mike, as all this is happening, there are changes coming to the federal program. We don't know what. And so council really got caught up in all of these debates the other night.
Let's face it, there's a stigma among some about people who have Section 8 housing. And even though you can't discriminate legally on race and religion and other things like that, you can, in many cases, discriminate on what the source of the money is. And as Eric said, that was one of the racial equity pieces of the Biden administration has to do with housing policy. So we'll see.
And the report that the committee is sharing now with the full council deals with woeful numbers from 2019. And they won't be able to deal with this until 2022 or 2023. So the wait time seems to be egregious. Okay, Eric, since you are here, we're going to get to talk about LaMelo Ball again. Last week, we talked about the meteoric rise of this 19-year-old superstar in basketball, and now how he's making the Hornets relevant again. We talked about how he's led the team to multiple wins, scored lots of points, and an inordinate number of rebounds and assists, and the youngest player in NBA history to get a triple-double. Now what? What do you want to talk about now?
Well, so Mike, the thing is, he's a big listener of the News Roundup.
Is he really?
So he heard
I'm glad to hear that.
He was so motivated that he went out on Monday night and hit 7 3-pointers. So that's what you have done for LaMelo Ball this week. And I want to mention this. Magic Johnson tweeted this week that the Hornets are one of the most exciting teams in the NBA. So this is all really a credit to LaMelo, motivated by Mike Collins.
Yeah, for that last 3-pointer, he said, this is for you, Mike.
Yeah.
Wow. Well, I'm flattered.
Put him in squawks. You're ready. He's ready.
If we ever come back because of the pandemic. Well, that's all the time we have for this ring dang do. Any more time would be dangerous and therefore illegal. Claire Donnelly has been with us. She's our healthcare reporter here at WFAE News. Mary C. Curtis, a columnist for RollCall.com, the host of their podcast, Equal Time, a contributor to WCCB-TV. Eric Spanberg, managing editor of the Charlotte Business Journal. And Hunter Sines, reporter for WCNC-TV. You made the cut, Hunter. Congratulations.
Woohoo!
Support comes from WFAE members and Mazda of South Charlotte, committed to Mazda's focus to ensure every element of a car is designed around the driver. More at MazdaofSouthCharlotte.com.